as what we've suffered recently.
Right.
And to have the President of the United States pardon this guy,
yes,
in order to help Jeb Bush, is what I understand was one of the reasons for pardoning him, it's beyond belief.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, if
so, in
those
other words,
those of us who follow the news live with hypocrisy day in and day out here, and everything you're pointing out is quite true.
Well, but it's also very troubling as a student of foreign policy, which I like to think I am. The tail can't wag the dog. The United States should own its own foreign policy. A group of fanatics exiled from another country in the United States shouldn't run our entire Western Hemispheric policy.
They run our policy, and they particularly run Miami. If you look at what happened in Miami during the Ilion case, the highest political offices in that city, the mayor and the county commissioner, both said that they would not allow their police to assist the Justice Department in carrying out a court order to have Ilion returned. I mean, that's the mentality that exists in Florida. And the America's Watch, which is no friend of Cuba, did a study of Miami in 1994, before Ilion and before the shootdown, which happened in 96. And they found that Miami has the most unhealthy civil liberties and civil rights climate of any major city in the United States. It is an utterly lawless place, particularly when you're talking about Cuba.
I thank you for joining us and filling us in on this story, Leonard Weinglass.
All right, thanks for having me in.
A pleasure. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Leonard Weinglass, who's an attorney for Antonio Guerrero, one of five Cubans convicted of espionage against the United States, and he's trying to get the case appealed on the basis that the trial was held in Miami, which is the heart of the Cuban exile community. And, of course, we have now a similar situation here with the venue vis-a-vis the Inglewood officers charged. And then, of course, we had earlier the L.A. riots were because of a verdict in Simi Valley for a case that took place in Los Angeles that was moved to protect the guilty. Let's take a short break, and we'll be joined in the studio by Azam Alwash, who's a board member of the Iraq Foundation, and we'll have on the phone George Lopez, a director of policy studies and senior fellow for the Kroc Institute of International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. We'll be talking about another war. We started out with a war in Colombia, and now we're going to talk about another war that President Bush is trying to start in Iraq, and hopefully if we have time, we'll take some phone calls. Welcome back to the Daily Review. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm joined in the studio by Azam Alwash, who's a board member of the Iraq Foundation. And I believe we'll have on the line George Lopez, who's the director of policy studies and a senior fellow for the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And Azam, you're an Iraqi exile. The United States, at least the President of the United States, has made it clear that he wants to go to war. He's talked about regime change. There was hearings before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee the other day. Many panels. First panel was pretty hawkish. The others were fairly questioning about it. This situation as it exists now is the President wants to do it. He's made it clear. The military is talking about options. The Senate and the House are starting to feel that they should get involved. Why should the United States fight your war?
Great question. First of all, I'm not even sure that actually the United States is going to go to war. I think this is all part and parcel of a big chicken game. we're going to be putting the pieces in place in Qatar and Saudi Arabia and wherever, Saddam Hussein can see what's happening. And I think it's basically the United States is trying to kind of scare him to death, as it were, to get the inspectors in. Having said that, given Saddam Hussein's history, even if he let the inspectors in, there's potentially going to be a confrontation sooner or later about weapons of mass destruction. Now, so the war is going to happen maybe not now, maybe 6 months from now, unless Saddam Hussein somehow changes his spots. Why should the United States fight this war? There are arguments that could be made based on both on the moral level as well as the security level. The United States there are two real options for Iraqis. Iraqis have been under sanctions for the last 10 years. Conceivably, if there's no war of liberation to help Iraqis remove Saddam, sanctions could last forever. And so from the Iraqi perspective, Saddam has been using the sanctions as an excuse or as a weapon through the ration cards to control the income or the food and the medicine of the Iraqi people. So they have been suffering for the last 10 years. And if, in fact, we don't help them remove Saddam, we could see endless 10 more years of this misery lasting in Iraq. Now, that's the moral argument. The security argument, of course, is that Saddam will eventually develop his nuclear weapon. And at that point in time, if you think it's difficult to make the decision to go after him now, it's going to be quadruply hard.
Okay. Let me bring in George Lopez. I take it, George. Well, let me ask you the same question. I don't believe you think the United States should go to war against Iraq. So tell me why we shouldn't.
Well, I think U.S. foreign policy objectives are a bit different, understandably, than the...
Are you on a speakerphone by any chance? Or?
Yes, is that adequate?
Could you just go to pick up the receiver? Much better.
Is that better?
Much better, yes.
All right. I think U.S. foreign policy objectives may be a bit at variance with some of the concerns expressed by Assam and the Iraqi people for their own internal well-being, and some of that differentiation of interests ought to be a subject of some of our dialogue, I'm sure. But one of the concerns expressed consistently through U.S. foreign policy since 1991 has been our goal to constrain the potential development by Saddam of weapons of mass destruction. And there are a number of us who believe that there's been not only an adequacy of that, but actually a real success at that in a number of ways over the past dozen years. And there seems to be no imperative at the moment to go to war to enhance the possible containment of that. That an enhanced containment system may in fact exist by strengthening border monitoring and by using maybe at least the threat of force as a way to convince Saddam that it's in his interests to permit inspectors to reenter.
And Azam, do you think inspectors make any difference? Because I had the main proponent for the war, at least the main salesman, is Jim Woolsey, the former head of the CIA, and I had him on about a week ago, maybe a little longer. And he argued that the inspectors absolutely didn't do anything, and it took the defection of the two brothers-in-law, or at least one of them, to Jordan to reveal the real existence of the bio program. So let me ask Azam, should we be skeptical about the abilities of inspectors to find weapons of mass destruction?
You don't have to take my word for it. You can go to Charles Dilfer, I believe you had him on Monday, right. Butler, who was on the Senate hearings. They themselves were the inspectors, and they themselves admitted that without help from the inside, as it were, they would not have been able to find evidence of the biological and biological research. I believe that Saddam. Right now, we have Resolution 1309 that is supposed to be enforced, which is the smart sanctions. Saddam has been able to bypass all of the inspection systems for the last 10 years. The sanctions have not prevented him from continuing to develop his weapons of mass destruction. It has slowed him down, yes, true. But now with the new system in place, with the dual-use equipment is going in, on Saddam's ability to export oil and also to cut deals with Syria and Iran to sell them oil at a reduced price under the table. I don't think that it's going. We're going to be able to control or limit his development effort in the way that it was, that we were able to do in the last 10 years. Unless, of course, oil prices drop tremendously down to $10 a barrel, then we have a different equation.
Well, that's I don't see that happening. George Lopez?
Yeah, I think I disagree on a couple of fundamental concerns. One is Resolution 1409 passed in May allows for the expansion of the importation of designated civilian goods. It does nothing to loosen Iraqi oil revenues. In fact, if the border monitoring system that we proposed in 1409 goes into effect, and there's evidence that it's beginning to, we're going to be able to constrain much more of the illicit oil flows through Syria than we were before 1409. Secondly, if you look at the record, whether it be the more current statements of Hans Blick of Omovic, or of Ralph Lacayus, or even of Charles himself, the purpose of inspections was to get a combined assessment of the international experts and people on the ground. So when we discovered the history of the biological weapons program, when we were able to get close to the development of potential nerve gas, when there were concerns raised about VX and the precursors to VX within the Iraqi system, all of those were a result of having specialized weapons inspectors on the ground. I don't think any of those analysts would deny that they were very effective on the nuclear, they were reasonably effective on the chemical, and when they were getting close to the biological is when in 98 they were booted out. This is what makes imperative getting the inspectors back in, because the inspectors at the very least slow development, they show where the leakages are. They can, in particular, tell us something about missile development, because one of UMSCOM's greatest successes up to 98 was the guaranteeing that Scud missile development had been controlled and many of those had been accounted for that were in the arsenal.
Well, let me just suggest, because I know that this is a subject that the public feel passionate about, at least some members of the public, and there hasn't been a national debate. There was hearings in the Senate, and there's actually a law in the land that you're supposed to have a debate before you go to war. And there was supposed to be a declaration of war, though there hasn't been one since Pearl Harbor. So let me invite the audience to call in if they have questions for Azam Alwash, who's a board member of the Iraq Foundation, and George Lopez. The number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. But let's continue here for a moment. Back to you, Azam.
One point on the issue of the new UN sanction, I believe George said it's 1409. My memory says 1309, but that doesn't really matter. Saddam's methods of work inside Iraq, yes, there is a list of prohibited items that is not supposed to go. There is always double dealing inside Iraq and cutting deals on the outside. Saddam is going to be able to generate an income that is hidden, through which he can buy things on the black market and bring it to Iraq. Having said that, please don't misunderstand me. I am not against letting inspectors in, by all means. In fact, forcing Saddam right now to get inspectors in will help us build the international case that we are going through the effort of trying to comply, to make him comply with the United Nations resolution.
Right.
I know Saddam's behavior from the past, and sooner or later there will be a confrontation. And I said that at the top of the program. Fine, let the inspectors in. I think right now we're going through a chicken game, and eventually Saddam, when he sees things are serious, is going to let the inspectors in. But make sure you understand that he is very good at playing games.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, and I expect him to be even more obstreperous than ever. What I ask of American foreign policy is that for all of the dialogue and planning we're doing for going to war, I think creative use of some of those same energies to have a new engagement with the Syrians, to a serious talk with the Turks, and a serious talk with the Jordanians as three venues that are going to be critical to border monitoring and to putting teeth into inspections that we weren't able to have in the mid and late 90s. It's pretty short-sighted in my mind in the analysis of American foreign policy to have a systematic effort being put forth on many fronts for how to go to war, and there be no fallback position which can accomplish some of the similar goals of weapons control, at least, and have virtually no work done on that whatsoever.
But one of the things, George, it was, Lopez, that was interesting about the Senate hearings, Mort Halperin's testimony, was that, in effect, if we, in order to get the cooperation from the Turks to launch air attacks, which are a precursor,
right,
you'd have to sell out the Kurds. But let me take some calls, because there's a flurry of calls here. Oya, you're on with Azam Alwash and George Lopez.
Hello, yes. I think George Bush is wagging the dog, and I'm really getting tired of these people coming on talking about Saddam with all of his weapons of mass destruction. The United States has more weapons than any other country. The United States has weapons of mass destruction. And what I'd like to see is someone come in and check the United States' weapons of mass destruction.
Well, let me try that question on the guests.
Saddam is one of the very few leaders, actually I think he's the only leader, that has used weapons of mass destruction against his own people, let alone the Iranians during the Iraq-Iran war, and he has used it in Halabja as well as in southern Iraq. He has also done things with conventional weapons that are unspeakable. The United States, disarming the United States of weapons of mass destruction, I think, is a non-starter, but I'll let George address that.
George?
Well, I share the sympathies of the caller, but I think there are a number of dilemmas we face. One has already been spoken to by my counterpart, and that is we are dealing with Saddam as someone with a track record of demonstrated use and a declaration of willingness to use again. But many nations, including the United States, are readily subject to international treaties and to inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, one of the little-known facts is that the International Atomic Energy Agency has been in reasonable dialogue with the Iraqi government for a number of years with regard to the weapons, nuclear weapons facilities that have been destroyed. This kind of cooperation can be enhanced across a series of countries, and that kind of pressure can add pressure to the United States to be more responsible about the development of its own weapons. That will be a longer process, but we have an immediate need at this time with regard to Iraq.
Let me bring on Jason. You're speaking with Azam Alwash and George Lopez, Jason.
Excellent. How are you all doing?
Fine.
Good. Listen, this is really hard, but this administration that we have to remember that the George Bush administration and the people that are working directly under him doing all this are fundamentalist born-again Christians. They do have a fundamentalist thought, just like the Al-Qaeda have a fundamentalist thought. It may be dressed up a little nicer in ties, and we are the United States, but going back to the taking our signature of the Kyoto Treaty, to this man doing whatever he wants to, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the College of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yes, the so-called School of Dictators. Let's not go too far afield. Let me ask the gentleman here in the studio about how much Christian fundamentalism is playing a part in this situation.
This is one of the curious points in history where the interests of democracy and the interests of the security of the United States coincide. There is a confluence of interest between democratic forces in Iraq and the interests of the United States in trying to de-weaponize Iraq or remove weapons of mass destruction from Iraq. Just because the Bush administration is a fundamentalist, as Jason has said, does not mean that you close your ears to the arguments that's being made. Listen to the Iraqi people and what they want. They want liberty. Yes, I don't think that this administration is doing what it's doing in Iraq for the sake of the love of the Iraqi people. It is obviously doing it for United States interests. But there is a very coincidental confluence of interest between the Democrats, the liberal Democrats like myself, and those of the conservative Republicans in the White House. Don't just close your ears. Listen to the arguments that's being made. And remember, in our history, did the French help us because they like us, or did they help us because they hated the British? Is it okay for us to accept help from the French, but not okay for the Iraqis to help to accept help from the United States?
Let me go to Farad, who is on line one. Farad, you're speaking with Azam Alwash and George Lopez.
Yeah, I'm on the line.
Yes, you are.
Okay,
yeah.
My first thing is that I'm as an Iranian. Let me tell Mr. Azam, that I would be really ashamed of some Iraqi to come to this country and become a CIA agent to work against the people of Iraq, to kill a million of people of Iraq since 90, and sitting here and talking about Saddam Hussein. Mr. Azam, either he has no knowledge of history as a so-called expert, or he's lying, because he knows that Churchill and the West were the first people who used a chemical weapon in the First World War, and the U.S. is the country who first used the nuclear bomb against the civilian people. And my question is this. How could you sit here and talk about the having the nuclear bomb or any other kind of bomb by Iran or Iraq or any other country when Israel has so many of them and the U.S. is working on a more and more nuclear bomb and calling it the tactical nuclear bomb? And we have in Farsi one thing that says the guy was running and the thief was running and calling the as a hold the thief. That means so people turn their eyes against somebody else so he can run away. That's what exactly the U.S. and the Israelis and the Zionists are doing in this country and the world. They are the ones who are using the nuclear bomb, all the bomb that they existed in their arsenal against the people of the world. They did it in Iraq, and now they're calling that Iraq has it off. It is the right of any country in the world to have any weapon he wants as long as U.S. and other countries have it.
Okay, Farad, let the gentleman answer.
To correct the record, I'm not a CIA agent.
I am. Maybe you've been getting my paycheck.
The issue, I encounter this kind of thinking and this kind of talk a lot of the times. The perspective of people from Iraq on this issue is slightly different than the perspective of Iranians or Palestinians for that matter. They tend to view everything in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian struggle. I want to tell you that Iraqis have struggled, have given a lot to the Iraq, to the Palestinians throughout their struggle of the last 40 years for recognition of their rights. At this point in time, we have been suffering under this oppressor for the last 30 years. There is no denying. I'm surprised that Farhad is trying to defend Saddam when Saddam developed new chemical weapons precisely to kill Islamic soldiers during the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, he killed, I don't know, 500,000 soldiers using
a lot of them are teenagers, right?
Exactly, with the keys of heaven hanging from their necks.
Let's bring in George because we haven't heard from you.
The passion of the caller reflects a general frustration of with American foreign policy that suggests that we have primary rights to weapons of mass destruction because we're more responsible than other leaders. I'm not about to at all argue with claims that Saddam is particularly a matter of concern because he's someone who's demonstrated use of these weapons. But at the same time, I think the passion of the caller argues for a tighter scrutiny in the U.S. about the motivations that would undergird preemptive strikes, the kinds of things we saw in the Nuclear Posture Review in February, and some of the rationale that's being offered out of Washington with why we need to go to war. In a world with multiple states holding weapons of mass destruction, the way to eliminate those or to hold leaders accountable to a responsible possession of those weapons is through a standard system of containment and deterrence and treaty making, not through the use of force to try to remove them preemptively. That will unleash a series of forces that will have an anarchy that is just destructive to hundreds of thousands of lives.
Let's go to Maria. Maria, you're on with Azam Alwash and George Lopez.
Hi. I think that I agree with the caller who says that the U.S. needs to have scrutiny, needs to be inspected as well, and to say that only Saddam has done the same thing, who has put germ warfare or whatever has tormented his people. We do the same thing here. Look at the guy that was arrested for not wanting to accept vaccinations. Look at the soldiers in Vietnam with Agent Orange. Look at the nuclear waste dumps that we have, we're subjecting people to, and the sites and where they put them and how things come up in the water. Look at the mining that goes on in near reservations or like Black Hills, etc. There's a lot of dirt that's here, and I think we really need to look in our own backyard before we jump the fence and look in someone else's.
Why don't you answer that one, George?
Well, I think these are some of the sentiments that need to be conveyed to Washington, but they also need to be conveyed with regard to understanding some of the differences between domestic...
Hello? Hello, George? You there with me?
Yes, I am. Are you there?
Yeah, you just dropped out for a second.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I think these concerns need to be expressed to Washington, but they also need to be concerns expressed within the context of a ongoing 12-year security dilemma we have with Iraq and an attempt by this rather harsh dictator to continue to acquire weapons of mass destruction. We need to limit his ability to acquire this material. That requires a certain particular set of foreign policies, which has to deal with border constraints, monitoring, surveillance, and a denial of the revenue from oil that would produce the income that he needs to purchase these things.
George, and Maria, ask yourself, why is Saddam so diligently spending money, millions and billions of dollars, to acquire these weapons? What is his purpose?
Part of the issue is to become a dominant force that has to be dealt with on his own terms, the ability to acquire weapons that make you an equalizer in the region. A second one is clearly the prestige of leadership that comes with that. And I think he has Pakistan and other states in mind when he sees the preeminence they have in the minds of the West, and would like to acquire that same kind of status.
And if we're having such a hard time making a decision to go after him without nuclear weapons right now, how difficult is it going to be to try to deal with him or his sons, for that matter, when they finally explode that bomb in western Iraq?
I mean, it's
going to be an extremely difficult situation in the Middle East. Israel has 200 bombs. Saddam could possibly, when he develops the nuclear weapon, could possibly hit it on Israel, and the consequences are enormous. So if we're willing to sit now and not make the move right now, there's going to be tremendous consequences to that decision 5 years from now.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. We've actually run out of time. We've got a flurry of calls here, and I apologize to the people who weren't able to get through to you. This has been the Daily Review. I'm Ian Masters. And I wish to apologize to Michael Slate, who does the Tuesday and Thursday editions of the Daily Review. I was led to believe that he was involved with Eisenberg and Rafael Renteria, the two Revolutionary Communist Party people, along with Markowitz, who were trying to take me off the air here, and who belong to the who run the Bylaws Committee and the other Programming Committee. So please, my colleague Michael, my apologies, and tune in to Michael Slate on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and also to apologies to his producer Armando Godinho. And I hope you tune in to Michael on Tuesdays and Thursdays and me on Wednesdays and Mondays. And I thank my guests, and special thanks to the callers, and my engineer Maggie Lupik, my producer Christine Blasnail. Please join John Wiener on the next Beneath the Surface, where he discusses Bush's Waco Economic Summit.
Thank you.
Yeah. What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Uh-huh.
Beneath the Surface with John Wiener is next. The KPFK Evening News Hour starts at 6 o'clock. Tonight at 7 on Feminist Magazine, meet the newly appointed editor of Ms. Magazine, Tracy Wood, and what to do when you realize that no matter how hard you've tried to avoid it, you have become your mother. Also meet cancer survivor Janet Orlin, who has decided to have her remaining breast moved prophylactically. She'll talk about her decision and how her doctors are fighting her. That's tonight at 7 on Feminist Magazine. Listen online at kpfk.org and tune in at 90.7 FM, KPFK, Los Angeles.
KPFK's mini summer fun drive is here, and we need volunteers to staff our phone room. The fun drive will start on Monday night, Tuesday morning, August 20th at midnight, and runs 24 hours a day through Friday, August 23rd at midnight. Whether you're a longtime supporter or a new listener, if you appreciate our mission, here is your chance to become part of the KPFK family. It's also a chance to raise hundreds or thousands of dollars for your radio station without having to write a check yourself. Contact us today and schedule time to come in and make a difference. You can sign up online at www.kpfk.org or call Keola, at 818-985-2711.